Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther. And in keeping with our tradition of only having great guests, we have another great guest for you today. Of course, I'm talking about Greg Weaver. Now, I probably don't need to say anything else because everybody's like, wow, Greg Weaver. Well, I know who Greg is, of course. But for those very, very few who may not know who he is, Greg served for 40 years across the civil service. He is one of the dons of the nuclear policy world who has thought long and deep about it. He spent time at Stratcom, time on the Joint Staff. I mean, he's done quite a bit. He's a guy I admired for much of my career. Of course, he's retired from the government now, and he's an independent consultant, but he's participating in programs at CSIS and the Atlantic Council and elsewhere, and he's staying busy. And now that he's not at the Pentagon, he's got lots of time to think and write, which was never really an option when you're in the Pentagon trying to deal with the daily life. So with that, Greg, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Well, thank you, Adam. Thanks for having me. It was flattering introduction, but thank you.
So you've been busy writing. I see your articles coming up every couple months probably, and retirement's giving you this opportunity to really sit back and think. And one of the pieces that you wrote here recently was a discussion of potential use of nuclear weapons in a Taiwan conflict. And of course, this is that we've had a response to your take on this, an article in War on the Rocks, but I wanted to get your perspective on this broader issue. We read and think about the war in Ukraine quite a bit. We think probably a little bit less, although we're cognizant of it, of, how might nuclear weapons be used in Asia or in a Taiwan conflict. So tell me, what's your take? How are you thinking about it? Where do you think we're heading?
Yeah, so the article I wrote, which you can find on the Atlantic Council's website, was really, I decided to write it because in my work as the senior advisor to the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, a lot of the Posture Commission's findings and recommendations were fresh in my mind. And one of those was the Posture Commission really focused primarily on what to do about the impending two-peer nuclear problem, where we have a peer adversary in Russia and in China. And part of that, one of the findings of the Posture Commission was that it would be preferable if the U.S. and its allies addressed the two-peer threat by creating conventional forces that could be sufficiently superior in both theaters simultaneously to be able to defeat Russia and China simultaneously. But the Posture Commission recognized that the U.S. and its allies may decide not to do that because of the cost or for other reasons. And if we decide not to match Chinese and Russian conventional capabilities in both theaters, the Posture Commission finding was that the United States would have to rely more heavily on nuclear weapons to deter and potentially fight in the second theater. And so the article I wrote about the role of nuclear weapons in a Taiwan conflict really looked at the different roles the nuclear forces in both China and the United States would play in such a conflict. And in that, the only, I think, probably controversial thing that I said in the article was that one potential role, and wasn't advocating this, by the way, I was just
sure, yeah,
clear that this was a potential role for U.S. nuclear weapons, was the first use of nuclear weapons to defeat the Chinese invasion of Taiwan, specifically by targeting the Chinese amphibious landing fleet while it stopped offloading for probably several days. It's a fixed target off the coast of Taiwan. And I just made the point that, you know, in the Cold War, we relied on nuclear weapons to compensate for conventional inferiority. And there's no military reason why we couldn't do that in a Taiwan scenario. In fact, it would be easier in a Taiwan scenario because an amphibious landing operation is kind of uniquely vulnerable to the use of a few nuclear weapons to defeat it. I think it's something we need to think about if we decide that our strategy is going to be to rely more heavily on nuclear weapons in a second theater conflict.
Yeah, it's always interesting because in many respects, as I write and think about things, I always look at, you know, from end to end, the courses of action you can take. And just by looking at those courses and presenting them as potential options, we're often, you know, labeled as extremist or advocating things that we're just saying, hey, you got to think from end to end. You got to think worst case scenario. And I wonder, as you think through it and thinking about where China is going with its, you know, nuclear breakout, and you've looked at China significantly, how do you think China is thinking about not only, you know, I don't know if they think that we'll use nuclear weapons. I kind of think they think we're going to try to employ conventional overmatch, which I'm not sure we'll have for more than a day or two. But how are they thinking about how we might use nuclear weapons? And then how are they thinking about how they might use nuclear weapons?
Yeah, so, you know, probably our toughest, the single biggest uncertainty we have in the sort of current nuclear strategy world is why did the Chinese decide that their reliance on 200 or so nuclear weapons and minimum deterrence and no first use, why did they decide that was no longer going to be sufficient? And why have they embarked on the biggest nuclear arms buildup since the Cold War that will result in them becoming a peer, according to declassified DIA intelligence community analysis, by 2035, they'll roughly be a quantitative nuclear peer of the United States in deployed weapons. Why did they do that? And we don't know. We don't know why. You can speculate on why, right? Xi may have simply decided, I'm unwilling to face the prospect of a conflict with the United States and be decidedly nuclear inferior. Why are we leaving ourselves in this position? But we don't know. We don't know what caused him to make the choice to do that. And we don't know how they're thinking about it. But what we can do is look at what they're doing, right? So we don't know what they're thinking, but we can look at what they're doing and what they could do. They're building a strategic nuclear force that is going to be a triad. It's going to have air, sea, and land legs. They have precision guided missiles, conventional long range, intermediate range missiles that could easily be mounted with nuclear warheads. Some of them are already capable, but they could be, you could see precision guided, terminally guided nuclear warheads, which would enable them to go very low yield and still be very effective at striking military targets throughout the Asia Pacific region. So I think they have watched what the role of Russia's nuclear forces and Russia's threats have been in constraining the United States and NATO not only not intervening in Ukraine, but in the levels and types of support given to Ukraine. So I think they're probably drawing some lessons from that. I hope they're also, by the way, drawing the lesson that you might have what you think is a really, really superb conventional military, but if it hasn't actually fought a large-scale combined arms operation in a long time, it may not do what you think it's going to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think we should be impressing upon them that the kind of operation they'd have to conduct to try to seize Taiwan is the hardest conventional military operation to conduct. Yeah. It took us 2.5 years in World War II to get to where we were actually good at amphibious landings. The first times we did it were disasters.
Yeah, absolutely. And we haven't really done it in, 70 plus years. So there's a reason it's not particularly popular. So how do you think they think about our willingness to use nuclear weapons? Because I would submit, I'll propose to you that I don't think they believe we would use nuclear weapons in a Taiwan crisis, even if, you know, it's going terribly for us. We've depleted our arsenals of PGMs. You know, Taiwan is on the brink. I would put my money that they don't think we'll pull out the nukes and use them. Even if, let's suppose, they wait until we have, you know, fielded Slick'em and we have, you know, lower yield options, or I don't think they think, you know, we're willing to fight that kind of fight. Am I wrong? And if so, why?
Well, I don't know whether you're wrong or not. Let me say a couple of things about that. So their perception of our willingness to do that, is going to primarily be a function of our stake. It's also partly a function of capabilities and what options we would have. But it's going to be their assessment of what our stake in the defense of Taiwan is, right? We don't have a treaty commitment to use nuclear weapons in defense of Taiwan, or to deter nuclear use against Taiwan, for that matter. So there's no formal extended deterrence relationship between the United States and Taiwan. And one of the central strategic questions we face is, well, what are we going to do about our current inability to fight and win in two theaters simultaneously? And then I said, well, we're going to have to think about whether we want to rely more heavily on nuclear weapons in whichever is the second theater if we get in a fight in one. And we need to know if that's going to be our strategy now so we can build a force that actually supports the strategy. But to go back directly to your question, we need to decide ourselves whether our stake in defending Taiwan is sufficient to risk nuclear war with China. Right? Because if we go to war with China, you are risking nuclear war with China.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, even if neither side intended in their strategy to use nuclear weapons first, wars have a nasty habit of going places no one thought they were going to go at the beginning. You know, everybody thought the American Civil War would be over in a week. And it was the bloodiest war in our history. So I just think that we have to sort out whether we want to rely on nuclear weapons and what the role of nuclear weapons is in deterring and fighting China in Asia. And it might be a war that's not over Taiwan. It might be a war over the South China Sea or something China's done to one of our allies. But I think the Chinese take seriously the possibility that the war could go nuclear. I think that's one of the reasons they're building up.
Yeah,
that's just my opinion, yeah. Right? I mean, I think when she looks at his security situation, he says, well, I don't want to go to war with the United States, but if I have to, from his perspective, like a Taiwanese independence declaration would force him to go to war. If I have to go to war with the United States, I sure don't want to do it with only 200 kind of 1960s, yeah, 70s level weapons. Right, I need an arsenal that looks something like the American arsenal to deter them from coercing us with nuclear weapons. Right, because when China didn't have nuclear weapons in the 50s, we coerced them with nuclear threats in the Korean War and in the Taiwan Strait, and that they're never going to let that happen again.
Yeah, it's a good point. I've wondered, you know, just thinking about a potential Taiwan fight where we're confident that the Chinese are not going to all of a sudden realize, that Taiwan has actually never historically been part of China, and that, you know, the Taiwanese are really sort of not Han Chinese. They're this unique mix of different things, and that You know, the Japanese had control of Taiwan for a longer period than the Chinese ever did. But that's sort of a history they're not going to sort of realize at any point. They want it. They think they've got to take it. And so I think we can all agree that there's probably a good chance that at some point that happens. And I wonder, is there any reason why the United States has not, I mean, there's obviously reasons why, but is it practicable to perhaps sort of like they were doing in the 70s, where the U.S. had some knowledge of the Chinese or the Taiwanese nuclear weapons program, and then ultimately we decided, hey, we'll pressure them to stop. But perhaps in this instance, we don't make that decision to pressure them to stop, because I have a feeling that if Taiwan were to have nuclear weapons, that their, you know, understanding of the history of Taiwan might change at that point. And they might come up with reasons why Taiwan is something that, as the Manchu emperors always said, you know, it's not part of China.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert on the history of Taiwan. I know what the history of our policy is, right? So our policy says it's part of China.
Yeah. Right?
We just say you can't, we're not going to let you resolve the dispute you have with the current authorities on Taiwan by force. But I think so I would not advocate Taiwan getting nuclear weapons, probably first and foremost, well, because it's not good for any other countries. We don't need any more countries having nuclear weapons than already have them. But second, and not too far behind that, I think if the Chinese found out that Taiwan was pursuing a nuclear weapon, they would go to war. They might not invade, but they would strike.
Absolutely.
To prevent it. You know, I think their view would be that would amount to enabling Taiwan to declare independence. And they wouldn't let that happen.
Yeah, that would be the challenge. Is could Taiwan covertly?
And I kind of doubt that, given what I suspect is the Chinese intelligence presence on Taiwan.
I
suspect they would have a very hard time, because it's not something you can do covertly very easily.
Yeah,
you know, it requires some unique facilities and some fairly large infrastructure, and yeah, you know, it's not like making biological weapons, which you can do in a brewery. You know.
Yeah. So it's that time of the show where we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to turn to the two-peer problem and get your take on, you know, are we correctly postured? You know, the Strategic Posture Commission made its recommendations, but I want to get your take. So you're listening to NuclearCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NuclearCast is brought to you by the Amlaw Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Greg Weaver. And before the break, I said, hey, what's with this two-peer problem? And of course, Greg has written about that here recently. So, Greg, tell me about the two-peer problem.
So let me start by saying I agree with pretty much everything the Strategic Posture Commission said, but I would, you know, there were some things that the Posture Commission couldn't say and still keep a bipartisan consensus on. And so I would, I guess, say go a little farther than what the Posture Commission said. So I think the first and probably the most important thing to understand about our posture vis-a-vis this two-peer problem, which is not here yet, but it's coming, is that if our strategy for how we're going to address the two-peer problem requires a nuclear force that's either bigger or different or both than what we currently plan to have in the program of record, of the modernization program of record, we actually need to know that right now. We can't wait 5 years to determine what our strategy is going to be particularly regarding nuclear weapons and the role of nuclear weapons in our strategy for the two-peer problem. We can't wait 5 years to figure out what that strategy is going to be. Because if the force it requires is bigger or different than what we currently plan, or both, and I think it's both, then we're not going to be able to build that force in time to meet the threat, right? We're struggling to just modernize the force we have. So we need to know now what our strategy is going to be so we can identify the force that's required for it. And when I say I think we need a bigger force and a different force, I would argue that we need a strategic nuclear force that's capable of achieving the president's objectives against both Russia and China simultaneously in order to be able to confidently deter both of them. And that's a force that's bigger than the New START force structure, because the target sets that are required to achieve the president's objectives in against both countries simultaneously require more weapons than in the New START sized force. Now, it doesn't mean that we have to have the same number. We don't have to double our force. We don't have to have as many weapons as Russia and China added together. That's not how that works, right? But we do need a bigger force than what we currently plan in strategic forces. And then I think the even more important change we need to make is we need to significantly improve our theater nuclear capabilities in both Asia and Europe. I'm an advocate of Slick Men, obviously. I co-chaired the NPR that recommended we acquire that. That was actually a military recommendation. It wasn't a Trump administration political idea. It was a military recommendation. But I think we should be looking at potentially some other additions to our theater nuclear capability as well. But we need to do the analysis and decide, well, what do our theater nuclear forces actually need to be able to do militarily, so that we can decide what kind of systems we need. And I don't think we've done that analysis for the two-peer threat yet. I could be wrong about that. I'm out of government for 2 years, but.
Yeah. I've spent a good bit of time here recently. I've been on a kick of reading about the decline and collapse of the Soviet Union and sort of what motivated it. And there's several new books that have come out from the Russian perspective on that. And one of the things that they talk a lot about is Gorbachev fundamentally understood that the system couldn't sustain the defense and nuclear enterprise as it was. It was, there was no economic growth. It couldn't produce what it needed. So he wanted to cut back. And specifically, INF was this, the Russians, the Soviets understood how threatening Pershing 2 and Glickham were. And so I spent some time in the Reagan Library going through all of the internal documents on our thoughts. And now I'm going through all the Russian thoughts. And it seems pretty clear that nuclear weapons that get to you quickly, that you can't defend against, and that are pretty close are cause great concern and pause for America's adversaries. And yet Asia is the perfect example of where we say, well, we're going to have, we'll have a couple of boomers in the Pacific, and that, that'll cover down on, deterrence in Korea and, deterrence for Japan. But I'm not quite so sure that that's sufficient. Tell me a little more about what you think in terms of, our potential needs in a theater nuclear weapons. Do you have places you want to put them, types? Do you want F-35s with B-61-12s in Korea at Kunsan? What specifically do you want?
Well, first I want Slick Men, right? And I'll tell you why. I mean, every time I walk through this list of attributes, I find out later that I forgot two or three. but because it's a long list of attributes that made Slick Men the theater weapon of choice, if you were going to add one capability, that why it's the capability of choice. First of all, it doesn't require that we convince any allies to deploy American nuclear weapons on their territory. Now, post-Ukraine, that might be easier in Europe than it was pre-Ukraine, but it's still a problem. It's still a political problem. There's benefits to having weapons on Allied territory because the linkage it creates and the burden sharing it creates. But Slick-A-Man is survivable day to day. It's not subject to being preempted if it's on attack submarines. It is in theater all the time, but the adversary doesn't actually know how many are in theater all the time because they can't see them. But they know American attack submarines are always in the theater in some number, right? They have some unique military attributes to them, not just political attributes, right? They sea-launch cruise missiles on attack submarines can be brought in very close to the coast and launched from inside the outer edges of an adversary's integrated air and missile defense system. So it doesn't have to penetrate as much. First of all, it's better at penetrating than an aircraft anyway because of its size and flight profile and all that. But it's also it also doesn't necessarily have to fly through as much of the defense as an aircraft, for example, or even a ground launch cruise missile that's launched from distance.
No CISNO, RISNO support required.
Right. They don't need any air defense suppression, right? It is, well, here's a factor that is interesting about cruise missiles that most people don't recognize, right? When people think about the range of a system, they tend to just think of a range arc on a map. And they say, okay, it gives you that much target coverage. But on a cruise missile, range gives you improved penetrability. Because if you're not shooting at a target that's at the outer edge of the range of the system, you have lots of range to use to plan flight routes that evade defenses, use terrain masking. There's a lot of tactics you can use with range on a cruise missile to improve its probability of arriving at the target and complicating the adversary's defense. So it's kind of ideal for that reason. The other reason is that while a sea-launched cruise missile would probably fly at something like the speed of an airliner, right, an aircraft, it is in theater so that the time between the president's decision to shoot and the time of a weapon arriving on target is low hours.
Yeah.
Right? You know, one of the arguments made for why we didn't need a sea-launched cruise missile was, well, we have air-launched cruise missiles on bombers. We'll just use those. Well, there's problems with that militarily, right? If you deploy the bomb, if you fly the mission from the United States, you've now got a 12-hour mission when the president says go to weapon on target. If what you're doing is a nuclear response, for example, to Russian limited nuclear use that was designed to coerce us into stopping, right, on terms the Russians like, right, do you really want to wait 12 hours for our response? How long is Putin going to wait before he shoots again to convince us to stop, right? I want a relatively prompt response. It doesn't have to be ballistic missile prompt, right? But I want something I call it operationally relevant timelines.
Sure.
and the other thing that the critics of Slick-A-Man don't seem to understand about it is that reducing the time from decision to weapon on target increases the president's decision-making time.
Yeah. Right?
Even if you were satisfied with the weapon not arriving for 12 hours, that gives him 10 hours to make the decision that he was not going to have if he had to do it a 12-hour mission. So there's lots of good reasons Slick-A-Man is good. I think a mobile ground-launched intermediate-range ballistic missile would be a good system. It's a little problematic in Asia where you'd put that. I mean, you could put them on Guam, but that would be a pretty long-range intermediate-range ballistic missile. I'm not keen on asking the Japanese to put U.S. nuclear weapons on their territory, really. I mean, you could, but Korea is not a good option, I don't think, simply because it's very close to North Korea, right? And aircraft in particular, right? They're tied to fixed air bases. easy targets. You know, that's why I wrote an article last summer in the NATO Review about the need to modernize NATO's nuclear theater nuclear mm-hmm. capability, and pointed out there that the dual capable aircraft capability is a legit military capability. I don't think it's useless, but the Russians could preemptively destroy it if we hadn't dispersed it.
Absolutely.
With less than 10 weapons. I'm not going to go into numbers, but less than 10 low yield weapons could take out NATO's entire theater nuclear capability. And then we'd have nothing but strategic, and the Russians would have, you know, roughly 2,000 minus less than 10.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So unfortunately, we're at that time in the show where I have to bring out, because this is a great discussion, but I got to bring out Bob the Genie. So if I bring out Bob the Genie and rub my magic lamp, and Bob pops out and he says, "Greg, you have 3 wishes. Now, you can't wish for fame or fortune or 3 more wishes. You got to make wishes about our topics." So, Greg, what is wish number 1?
So my first one would be that that DOE and NSA more rapidly rebuild our nuclear weapons production infrastructure, because that's the long pole in our tent. And we seem to be struggling to do that in ways that I don't quite understand. I don't understand why this is so hard. I mean, I understand that it's high tech and but it's all things we've done before. Right. So it baffles me a little bit that we're not able to rebuild that infrastructure more quickly. It's wish 1.5. It's part of that wish that in doing that modernization of the infrastructure more quickly, we also expand the capacity of the infrastructure, because I think we've learned a very hard lesson about you should never plan to have a supporting infrastructure that can just barely do what you think you're going to need in the future. You need to plan some surplus capacity in case things change.
Absolutely.
And we didn't do that, and now we're paying the price. My second wish is to get Slick-M-N fielded as quickly as possible for one simple reason, and that is that I think while I don't think nuclear war is likely, I think the most likely path to nuclear war is adversary limited escalation in a theater war that they start losing. Yeah. And I think Slick-M-N is critical to both deterring that and to also being able to fight in that kind of a conflict.
Yeah.
And then third, I guess, there's a lot of options. all right, I'll go with, I wish everybody that listens to this will immediately go get a copy of the Strategic Posture Commission report and read it, because I think it's a fairly astounding consensus document that calls for a very different posture than what we currently plan. And it encompasses all the things I talked about today in one form or another. So reading that document, and not just the executive summary, read the whole thing. And recognize, look at who the members of that commission were, and recognize that all the Democrats on that commission agreed with what's in that document.
Yeah. Well, Greg Weaver, thanks for a great discussion.
Well, thanks for having me.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast, and we'll see you next time. Well, it was great to talk to Greg. I mean, he's been one of those guys who I've watched his career and watched him move from Stratcom to the Pentagon, and you know, he's one of the dons of the policy world. And so it was great to have a chance to talk to him and hear what he had to say. And, you know, he gave me some new ideas, some things I had to go, I hadn't thought about that. So hopefully you'll enjoy the show equally as much.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Channington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it, and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.